be the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday of 4th of July week. Good to be with you today. If you're still like me, you still have no idea what day it is. I mean, is it Tuesday? Is it Friday? Is it whatever? I am lost this week, but I'll tell you what, I got a great treat for you today to hedge into the weekend. By the way, I should mention Hunter in with us here today.
Hello.
Hey, Hunter, did you have a nice 4th of July Independence Day?
I did have a nice 4th of July. I marched in the Chanhassen Parade.
Well, really? Yeah. were you picking up litter at the end of it? What were you marching with? Who were you marching with?
Donzel Leggett, the campaign I'm working with.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I saw the pictures. You were
out there. Huge turnout. It was great.
Well, it's a parade. I mean,
huge turnout for Donzel. His opponent marched by himself. Yeah.
Who was his opponent?
Vince Baudette.
Baudette?
Yeah.
Lonely guy. That's one lonely parade. I'll talk about that. I'll ask you some more about that in just a little bit. Molly Beck's going to join us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's going to talk a little bit about Foxconn, which is already backtracking, and also Harley Davidson. But joining me right now is the exceptional writer from City Pages. Susan Dew is kind enough to join us today. She has an amazing cover story on City Pages this week, and she's nice enough to join us today to talk about this. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and I appreciate the time. I know you've been doing a lot of interviews about this story because this story is amazing. And one of the reasons why it is amazing, for me at least, is that I was in high school. I just graduated high school in 1986. And I remember this case. And not only do I remember this case, but what your article brought up was a lot of memories that I'm questioning a lot of now. Let's talk a little bit about Mr. Billy Glaze, who unfortunately has passed away recently in prison. He was in jail for a long time, correct?
That's right. He was convicted of three murders that occurred in the late 1980s and spent 27 years incarcerated for them until his death in 2016.
These murders really scared Minneapolis pretty bad because it seemed as if a serial killer was running about, correct?
Right. They were extremely gruesome murders. There were three women who were murdered. They were all vulnerable Native American women who were unemployed, poor, who had struggled with alcoholism at some point in their lives. Two of whom had dabbled in prostitution, all mothers, and they all tended to hang out in the same Native bars that were popular at the time. And the Native community was very tight and insular. And when these series of killings happened, nobody knew who was responsible. There were no eyewitnesses that came forward right away. And when police finally came forward and said, you know, everybody's got to be on guard because here's what we're dealing with. A killer who brutally beats his victims and then mutilates their bodies in a way that's meant to terrorize folks. It really did set off a bit of hysteria in the community.
Kathleen Bowman was the first victim, correct?
Right.
Yeah. And she was found over basically, you paint the picture that it was kind of over where Target Field is now, that it was over in that area where she was discovered.
Right, yeah. And a lot of the area wasn't developed at the time. So, another victim was found on what is now the Midtown Greenway. The second victim was found by the American Indian Center.
By the way, it was Angela Green found underneath the Park Avenue Bridge. I remember that was the one where the media in this town kind of went nuts at that time. I mean, there was a lot of big stories. And as a matter of fact, I can almost make an argument that that was one of the cases which led the city to look at that greenway and have to revive it because of people being scared of, you know, they don't want to be off of Lake Street and then all of a sudden get murdered down under that bridge. And so it was a sensational story at the time. How exactly did the police finally start to zero in on Billy Glaze?
Yeah, that was interesting. Although they didn't have a lot to go on. Like I said, there were no eyewitnesses that came forward right away. And the victims were all found in these heavily traveled areas that were sort of homeless hotspots that were all filthy with trash. And so it was very hard to pick out relevant evidence to test. When they heard about Billy Glaze, it was because a relative of the third victim, a young woman who had actually grown up in Minneapolis and had a larger family here than the other two victims, her step-aunt overheard Billy Glaze saying some pretty crazy things about people at this diner where she worked. Billy was this 45-year-old, mentally low-functioning drifter who attended a lot of the same Native American bars that the victims attended, and he was known to say just gruesome and disgusting things about pretty much everyone that he came across, strangers and acquaintances alike. And so at this diner where the step-aunt of the third victim worked, Glaze was known to say things like he wanted to sexually assault Native women, that he wanted to kill a disabled woman for laughing out of turn, and he was generally saying very troubling things. So obviously police were interested in him, and they arrest him after he leaves Minneapolis and runs a red light in New Mexico. And his face and his name appear in the newspaper. After that, a bunch of so-called witnesses start crawling out of the woodwork. Many of them are jailhouse informants who could stand to gain something from giving police any amount of information. For instance, one guy said that he'd actually witnessed the first murder of Kathleen Bowman. But then he also said to police that he was drunk and high to the point of hallucination at the time, and he wasn't really sure if anything he saw was real. Another woman called from jail and said she saw Billy Glaze with another victim, but then she described him as having a tattoo that he didn't have and a truck that he didn't own. Another convicted burglar called from prison and said that he saw Billy standing near the spot where the third victim's body was eventually found. And these were all meant to weave together in a way to make the jury visualize Billy Glaze sort of crossing paths with the victims shortly before their deaths. But the problem was that these testifiers were all extremely flawed or inconsistent or biased or motivated by self-promotion, and they didn't necessarily come forward with anything that hadn't already been known to police that had been published in the news. And, they had various connections. The burglar who allegedly saw Glaze standing, you know, next to where the one body was found, actually had 6 months of his sentence knocked off by the prosecutor in Billy's case for help testifying. So, although throughout the years, the county attorney's office has always leaned on this phrase, describing their case against Glaze as having this overwhelming evidence of guilt, to describe how confident they felt about his conviction. Just below the surface, you can pretty obviously see that a lot of this so-called evidence, even though it might still overwhelm, is actually not very good evidence. And there was no physical evidence connecting him to any of the victims or any of the crime scenes.
Your story says, as a suspect, that how he was identified by the media as a suspect in the Minneapolis killings, that was underselling it. I mean, he was the killer. I mean, and I remember that. I remember how it was written about. I mean, this was the guy. And you talk about, and let's say Billy Glaze is not exactly, a choir boy here. I mean, he definitely has some rough traits. But at the same time, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to agree with you. He's extremely unlikable. actually.
And imagine, and that's, which is, you did a fantastic job on this article, because he is unlikable, and that comes across. I mean, this is not, you know, a hero that, you know, necessarily, but this, these testimonies, these witnesses, I mean, like you said, I mean, the woman who said he had a tattoo in a truck, that should have been the end of her. How in the world she was allowed any kind of testimony? I mean, she clearly was flawed. The police were really, they liked the way that Glaze looked as the guilty party, and it seems as if there clearly was a very honed, blinders on vision here. He's our guy. We are throwing him in jail.
Well, there was immense pressure to convict somebody because there was a serial killer on the loose. And, you know, the police chief of the Minneapolis Police Department at the time basically summed up everybody's feelings about these cases. He said, we should find the murderer and execute him. I think that's what people felt about it, because the crimes were just so, so extreme. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask though about, I mean, what did you learn about his defense team? I mean, it doesn't sound like they did anything to help this guy. I mean, these witnesses, like you said, no physical evidence to link him to these crimes, and the witnesses were their stories should have been easily punched through. Why didn't the defense do a better job of defending the guy?
You know, his trial attorneys were actually, they actually became, you know, one went on to become a judge. One is still a highly respected defense attorney in Minneapolis. He had a very good legal team, but you got to kind of contextualize this as, you know, trial in the days before modern science. And the prosecution did a good job of basically inundating the jury with all these circumstantial, you know, the circumstantial web of potential connections, that they made a very compelling argument that, you know, he's the best guy that they've got. It's hard to punch holes in a very complex case that was built. So I can sort of empathize with them on that. There were times when the defense seemed to mess up, in that they failed to tell the jury that one of the testifiers against Billy Glitz had a very close connection with another woman who was killed in an unrelated case. Her murder was never solved, but the family believed that Billy should have been tried for her as well. A lot of these sorts of details slipped under the radar until, you know, decades later, when the Innocence Project found them out. So, you know, after DNA testing came about in the late 90s, early 2000s, that was when juries and the public started to learn about the fallibility of eyewitness testimony, mm-hmm. about how common it is that people will falsely confess to things that they had never done, and how the more notorious a crime is, in fact, the more false accusers will try and step up and take responsibility for their 15 minutes of fame or whatever crazy reason that people have to falsely confess to crimes. So these are all perspectives that, you know, we as a public have come to realize more about. But in those days, it was pretty much like prosecutors did have a lot more leeway with circumstantial evidence, and juries tended to believe them more.
You know,
in my opinion,
you bring up what is one of the more unique elements of this story. In 2003, Hennepin County Attorney's Office submitted a smattering of evidence from old cases for new DNA testing. Among the items was a bloody jacket found near Angelina Whitebird Sweet's body, the second victim. The jacket would yield no new information, yet the Innocent Project of Minnesota pointed to the testing as a reasonably, prosecutors has always harbored doubts about this. This started down a path, and once again, as you talk about, you know, us learning our lesson about DNA evidence and how things have, you know, we were wrong about some things, there are some trends that happen that are undeniable. And the minute all of a sudden that we start realizing, wait a minute here, this person we have locked up for a long time might not have done the crime, when we start doing this, then there becomes this wall that starts to form saying, no, we got the right guy. No need to look any further. Don't look behind the curtain sort of thing. A lot of people pushed on this one, and they ended up not only getting some other evidence tested, but finding some pretty remarkable results.
Right. Yes. So going back to 2003, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office tested that bloody jacket. And because DNA was burgeoning on in the criminal justice scene, they were testing a smattering of evidence from all sorts of different cases to just basically double check to prove to the public that they were open-minded, that they recognized and acknowledged this new science, and they were going to be thorough and transparent. But when they tested this one piece of evidence, you know, Billy Glaze wrote to the Innocence Project and said, look, they really need to test everything in my case. Just testing one piece and not finding, you know, any new results from that doesn't mean that they have they've done their due diligence in making sure that they really did convict the right person. So the Innocence Project took him on that, and they argued for him in court to have the evidence released from his case so that they could do a very thorough DNA analysis. And the problem immediately was that they discovered so much essential evidence had been lost or destroyed throughout the years, had never been returned from court after trial. Essential stuff like the murder weapons and bloody clothing from the victims, stuff that, you know, but there was still a lot that they could test. A lot of, you know, bottles left at the crime scenes, cigarette butts, some pieces of clothing, some pieces of debris. And they tested about 40 different artifacts and found that nothing linked to Billy Glaze, which is significant because these were violent and bloody crime scenes. What they did find was two extremely important connections. The third victim, her forensic slides that the medical examiner prepared showed that there was semen left on her body. And this resulted in a DNA profile that was eventually matched to a convicted felony rapist who raped a Native American woman who was a stranger to him in a very violent and brutal way that was very similar to what had happened in these crimes. There was also a cigarette butt from the crime scene related to a different victim. And so this was exactly what the judge was looking for when he agreed to let the Innocence Project test this evidence. He said, you know, he reasoned that because these scenes were, you know, highly trafficked, it wouldn't necessarily matter if you found one person's DNA on any one victim or on any piece of one piece of evidence. But if you have multiple pieces of evidence showing the same DNA profile of the same person that were taken from different days, different victims, then this was a really compelling, you know, redundancy. And so that could be exonerating. And that's exactly what the Innocence Project found.
And that's exactly what it is. It's a shocking bit of evidence which contradicts the entire case against Blaze and points the finger at another individual, which I'll tell you what, I'm going to tell people to go read this article. You need to read this. This actually is exceptional work by you, Susan. It really is amazing. But the final thing I want to just ask point out is something that you talk about here. That when you have a criminal who's been convicted on eyewitness testimony, no physical evidence, and then DNA proves this, and you have this reluctance to prosecute and admit, the one thing that's always left out there is there's a person, and as your article points out very well here, there's a person running around, whether it's the individual that you allude to in the article or someone else, who murdered three people and has not faced any jail time for that. And that's something that scares me to death.
Right. Well, that was, you know, a major point of contention because the Billy Glaze died in 2016, and that was why the district court threw out his petition for a new trial. They said it was moot because, you know, he's dead. Dead men can't litigate, and Billy Glaze will never benefit from having his name cleared, even if it was his dying wish. The Supreme Court of Minnesota this March finally ruled the same way. And after a decade of litigation, all of this was basically thrown out. But still, the Innocence Project argued that you still have an alternate perpetrator with who is linked, you know, by good evidence to these crimes, who is walking free. And he's not an elderly man. He is middle-aged. He could potentially still pose a threat. And at the end of the day, if the criminal justice system doesn't have to acknowledge this case as, you know, as a teachable moment, then, you know, they don't have to take responsibility for what could have been done better and to improve the system in the future. So, yeah, for them, it was a loss that everything was just dismissed because he died.
Well, Susan, this is just such a great article. I'm going to link to it later on. Find a copy of City Pages. Go to citypages.com. You can find the article there. Susan, just congratulations on another stunning cover story there. Thank you very much for the time and all my best.
Thank you so much, Matt.
My pleasure. We'll spotlight this one for sure. Absolutely. Susan Du from City Pages, my highest recommendation, go read this article. This is stunning work by Susan here on this case. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.
This is Dan Brooks, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with RBC Wealth Management. For the past 19 years, I've been managing wealth for individuals, institutions, and corporate retirement plan sponsors. Throughout my career, I have seen common traits in successful investors. They include the courage to be diversified, the willingness to work with a professional, the discipline to follow a plan, and patience. I welcome the opportunity to help contribute to your financial success. Call me at 612-371-2396.
Located just north of 50th and France, the Great Wall Restaurant has provided a delicious taste of authentic Chinese cuisine since 1981. Specializing in Sichuan and Peking dishes, they offer one of the most extensive menus in the Twin Cities. Favorites include hot and sour soup, pan-fried dumplings, and mushu pork with homemade Chinese pancakes. Stop by their Edina location or call for takeout at 952-927-4439. See the full menu at greatwallrestaurant.us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Scott Chambliot from Chambliot Family Dentistry. We're the fear-free, get-you-out-of-pain-now dental office.
And I'm Rachel Chambliot. Did you know a lot of people are afraid of the dentist? You don't need to be afraid of my dad. He makes going to the dentist comfortable and even fun.
We don't care if you're a dental regular or haven't seen a dentist in years. We just want to make you comfortable and get you out of pain.
If you don't see my dad, please see another dentist. Take care of your teeth because they're the only ones you get. Call 1-800-FIX-MY-TEETH or visit fixmyteeth.us.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is all digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
Tom Hartman here telling you that solar energy isn't just for environmentalists. Switching to all-energy solar is actually perfect for reducing your carbon footprint while also saving money on your monthly electric bill. The fact that solar panels cause no earth-harming emissions while it's producing energy is a bonus. Who in the world could object to that? But they can also help you save money month after month for decades. And they do it with a clean footprint. So go green and start saving money today by visiting allenergysolar.com.
What's stunning to me about that entire article is this was one of those guys, you said, they got him. that there was no doubt, there was zero doubt they had the right guy. And after reading Susan's article and the way she lays out the evidence, the wrong guy died in jail. You took an innocent guy, and I'm not saying this guy is a dreamboat. I mean, he had some real issues. He was a very dislikable individual. And they point to, and if you read the article, they point to the fact that he was desperately trying to get transferred from Delaware. They moved him to Delaware to keep him away from Minnesota tribal gangs and prisons. So they moved him to Delaware, and he was trying to get transferred to California. And so I did these murders and stuff, and he just said it. The reality is there's DNA evidence which clearly says, this was this other guy. And once again, I want to remind everyone, Blaze went to jail. He went to jail not because of any DNA evidence or anything. Excuse me, I said Blaze. Glaze. Glaze went to jail not because of any concrete evidence, but circumstantial and eyewitness testimony, which already one or two of the people have already said, no, that I was wrong. And once again, one of the people who says she's right claimed he had a tattoo and a truck. He didn't have either of those things. So how in the world that testimony was used to convict this guy, I don't know. But that's stunning. And it's, like I said, it makes you question the entire system yet once again. Because this was no doubt. And I remember Care 11 back then, and I 11 Channel 4 back then, and I remember the Star Tribune back then, all saying, this guy guilty, 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 guilty. No question, no doubt. And if it wasn't for the fact that they tested the jacket, and whether or not the prosecutors want to presume that that testing of that jacket was just circumstantial, it had nothing to do with them thinking that Glaze was innocent. The reality is one circumstantial thing like that basically led us to figure out, oh, we pretty much, jailed and killed a guy that shouldn't have been jailed. So, wow. Excellent work. Excellent, excellent. We're going to take a break. When we do come on back, Molly Beck from the Milwaukee County Journal, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I should say, is going to join us. We'll talk about Foxconn, the latest on that, and Harley Davidson as well. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
The fine folks at Common Good Books will help you find the perfect book for you or the book lover in your life. Find a huge selection from a locally owned and independent bookseller in the Twin Cities. They are always bringing in top authors from around the globe for special in-store events. Open Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Find Common Good Books at 38 South Snelling Avenue in St. Paul or shop online at commongoodbooks.com.
Crazy about pets? We are too. The Pet Connection Show is a great venue for fun, informative, and creative conversations about pets. Join myself, Kathy Menard, and Dr. Nicole Parole, along with guests who are leaders in the dynamic and growing pet industry, as we discuss healthcare, relationships, behaviors, and even political issues as they relate to our pets. So come, sit, stay for the Pet Connection Show, Sundays 11 a.m. to noon on AM 950 Radio, the progressive voice of Minnesota.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.co. OP.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday of Independence Week. Reminder, with the holiday week, we're featuring all the eatlocalminnesota.com restaurants. Go to eatlocalminnesota.com, find a great local restaurant. Many of them locally sourced. You get a great local meal, and the money stays local. Eatlocalminnesota.com. From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Molly Beck is kind enough to join us today to talk about some of these stories we've been covering with her over in Wisconsin. Molly, I hope you had a wonderful Independence Day.
I did. How was yours?
It was busy. We had rain up here. Was it raining down in Milwaukee, Madison area?
No rain, but it was very, very hot. Ugh. So maybe uncomfortable in a different way.
Let's just go with Foxconn. You and I have talked now about four or five times about this grand deal where Foxconn, I mean, and this is Scott Walker's baby. You know, they gave mm-hmm. what was the total amount of state taxpayer dollars they gave Foxconn to come move in their facility over there?
So in tax incentives, it was about $3.5 billion. And then if you include the local incentives that the county where that facility will be built, it comes to about $4 billion.
This is something, and you and I talked about this. I mean, this is great if it comes to fruition. It's a lot of, but even still, if it comes to fruition, it's at maximum capacity. It hires all Wisconsin people, no one from Illinois, and it does its job. It still would be, what, 25 years before the state would see a return on that investment, correct?
Right, that's right. And that was when it was unveiled, that was a key criticism from Democrats that it's just going to take too long before the state sees a financial, a positive effect from it. So they're still talking about that. They have broken ground. Donald Trump was here last week, I believe, or the week before with Scott Walker, and they broke ground on the site where this $10 billion plant, they'll be producing LCD panels, will be built in southeastern Wisconsin.
Once again, if it comes through and ends up making money, it's a good investment. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to die, but you and I talked about the precarious nature of this investment, and a lot of things have to go a very specific way. And already, was it Foxconn that started talking about their production, what they were going to be doing at this facility? It sounds like there are some people pulling back on the hiring goals and what exactly the facility is going to do. Is that correct?
So there's been some news in recent weeks that the facility is not going to be doing exactly what they said they thought it would be doing when this deal was being put together between Governor Walker and Foxconn. And they've said that they might be scaling back what they're doing, mostly in a response to technology and the demands of technology and what people want now. As everybody knows, that can change really quickly. And even in the span of the time that we've been talking about this facility, it sounds like the kind of LCD panel that they're talking about might be different by the time they build this facility. So the hiring goals, they haven't said that would change at all, but I did see recently that one of the Foxconn officials said that the 13,000 jobs that I think a lot of people thought were going to be in the facility near Racine might be spread across Racine and other Foxconn sites that might pop up across the state. They just were in Green Bay right after the groundbreaking in Racine area, to say that Foxconn has purchased a building in Green Bay and they're going to have 200 high-tech jobs there. So it could be that there's, 10,000 jobs in the Racine area and then the 3,000 others elsewhere.
You, and by the way, I do want to make sure I give you credit because you basically said that one of the first times you said is that this is a pretty big gamble because when you're looking at a 25-year return on investment, the technology in 25 years ago, we were listening to cassette tapes. And so It's a pretty big gamble that they're going to be using this facility and continually upgrading said facility to match the technology as needed. When you talk about possible sites getting some of these jobs, have they mentioned possibly out of Wisconsin, or is it only if they're just saying that it might not be the 1,300 here, it might be just around the state?
I mean, they will not get the full $3.5 billion from the state if those jobs are not in Wisconsin. So if they decide to build a facility in Minnesota, for example, and move 5,000 jobs that they were going to have in Wisconsin or expected to have in Wisconsin over there, they're not going to get that full $3.5 billion in tax incentives. So, I mean, it's possible they might do that anyway, and it might be, you know, they might find that to be a better, you know, decision for them. But if they want to get the state incentives, they have to bring the jobs here.
Well, and going back to something else you had mentioned before is some of this money of that $3.5 billion is guaranteed. So no matter what, they're going to get that, correct? How much is that, $2 billion, 2.1?
It's about almost $2 billion, yeah. They get about half that if they just build a facility. So, and then the rest of it is tied to the jobs.
Seems like they're getting out pretty good already. Obviously, you brought up Trump, that he was out there. I mean, that made not a lot of national news on this and talking about technology jobs. But that was before today, where really this new trade war has begun. Are there concerns that a trade war with the European Union, Canada, Mexico, China? I mean, those are the four, you know, entities that Trump's trying to go to war with as far as trade. Is there a concern that's going to impact the sustainability and the ramp up of this facility?
I don't know about the facility specifically. There's been not a lot of discussion about that, but there has been a lot of discussion about existing Wisconsin businesses and industries here that will be affected by the tariffs. And I, you know, right when that groundbreaking was happening, Harley Davidson had said that they were going to move some of their production overseas in response to the tariffs. And President Trump, in a series of tweets, was very, very critical and said that if they do that, they're going to be taxed like never before. And then the most recent tweet was basically saying that he was going to help Harley Davidson's competitors if they did that. And so Governor Walker was in a very awkward spot, because if anybody has ever met or talked to Governor Walker, they know that he really likes Harley Davidson. He has a Harley. He wears motorcycle boots on campaign stops. His campaign stops are often at Harley stores. So there was a lot of reporters asking him what he thought of the president's threats, or at least that's how Democrats were characterizing them. And, you know, he said that he didn't agree with the tariffs, but he didn't comment directly on the president's comment.
Well, and their so-called threats, those were threats. I mean, he was very pointed, saying, "I'm going to go punish them." This is interesting to me now. And first of all, let's talk about Harley Davidson a little bit as well, and talk about it from the corporate standpoint. I feel sorry for them because they are one of those iconic brands, Jack Daniels, Levi's, Harley Davidson's. And when you get into trade disputes with other countries, those are the businesses that are first looked at, because they are iconic and they are something where it's a worldwide brand that's had success that can trace itself all the way back to Wisconsin. I imagine for you know, they're going through a lot of stuff in as far as the company goes. They're going through a lot of this in regards to just, you know, we're trying to do a business here. This is not exactly, you know, helping. I mean, I think even the CEO was very pointed in his kind of, no, this is all a creation of Trump's doing.
So the production that they want to move overseas is, you know, the bikes that are going to be sold in the EU. So they're just going to move the production over there, so they are not subject to the tariffs. And so it's not, you know, all of their production by any means, and they're still going to be based in Milwaukee. But there are, you know, obviously Wisconsin lawmakers here who don't want to see that happen, even if it's a small percentage of their production. They want to keep those jobs in Wisconsin or the United States if they're not in Wisconsin. So it's the, you know, the discussion on that, the argument over that is still ongoing. So we'll see what happens.
I just don't understand what Trump's trying to do there, though. I mean, so good for Harley Davidson. They're a big enough company to where they can, and it's, this is not necessarily good for Wisconsin. I mean, I imagine there's a few jobs they're going to be losing in the state. But there is a company they can weather this by basically just putting an assembly factory in Europe, leave that to be a European Harley Davidson, you know, company, American company. They get around this. But Trump, with his comments, you know, it really is, you know, he's very pointedly going after this company, and he is making threats, saying, "I'm going to work for your competitors, and try to make their sales go up." I mean, this is getting bitter. I mean, it's hard to watch him turn on a brand, which frankly is a brand that is embraced by conservatives.
Right. And I, you know, and we haven't heard anything from Harley about the president's comments. And I don't know if that is because they don't think this, you know, the so-called threats are going to turn into anything real for them, or if they're still trying to figure out, you know, how to respond, or if they think maybe these tariffs aren't going to happen, you know, it's done. So I'm not sure, you know, where Harley will go from here, but. And it's possible they just ignore it because they know that, you know, there are plenty of their customers are conservatives, and plenty of their customers voted for Donald Trump.
What is the pulse on the people of Wisconsin, though? I imagine next to the Green Bay Packers, this is probably the most iconic Wisconsin brand out there. And I can't imagine Trump declaring war on Harley Davidson is going over well in the state.
It's hard to say. It's one of those things that I agree with you that I wonder how people feel about it, but we don't, you know, there's not 100 reporters who can go out and talk to everybody about how they feel, and there hasn't been any polling on it. But I think it's safe to say that there's, you know, big Harley supporters in Wisconsin because of, you know, the fact that they're based here in Milwaukee. They're still based here in Milwaukee. But at the same time, I don't know how if they might agree with the president's approach too. So it's a tough situation for a lot of people here.
If you're a Republican in Wisconsin and you're running for office, this is just a nightmare scenario because you just got to hope, okay? Because what you just said is perfect. Is that it's kind of even keeled right now. It's not great news. You got there are some positive. Foxconn's opening, digging ground. They got this new building in Green Bay. You know, Harley Davidsons are still, you know, an iconic brand. But it's not good news either because Foxconn seems to be wondering if they're going to change up what they're going to do there with the technology. And you have Trump specifically, pointing out Harley's as a now evil American business, which is really bizarre. If either of these things go worse, I mean, it creates a difficult situation for the Wisconsin Republican politicians because, you know, you don't want this Foxconn stink coming over you if all of a sudden they back out and they say, okay, we're going to pull back on a trade war. Or if Harley Davidson starts becoming more pointed as a private business against Trump for attacking them, it puts them, as you described with Scott Walker, it puts these politicians in a really ugly situation where they either have to go against an iconic state business or the business of the future in Wisconsin, or they have to back up Trump.
Right. I think, and you see that awkward position in the fact that a lot of prominent state Republicans here haven't said anything about the president's comments about Harley. And that's probably because, you know, it's with the president, it's unpredictable for them, you know, what he's going to say. And so oftentimes we've seen them just try to not comment on it. I think Paul Ryan said the most pointed thing. He said he thinks, you know, the tariffs just are taxes on businesses and doesn't think that's a good idea. But with the Foxconn issue in this fall, these fall elections, I mean, even without the trade war, I think Foxconn is an iffy issue for Republicans, just based on recent polling. There's not overwhelming support for the Foxconn project, and most people think that it won't benefit their area of the state if they are not in the Milwaukee and southeastern part of the state. So there's been a lot of I would call it a campaign by Governor Walker and other Republicans lately since that poll came out to what they would say educate the voters about the project and the, you know, expected benefits from their perspective. So I think the Foxconn issue is something that Republicans are still trying to turn voters' attitudes on.
Well, and you and I, last time we talked about cranberries, which obviously affects Wisconsin directly. And then Canada, was it earlier this week or late last week? This last weekend, they went out there, and part of their return trade tariffs was a yogurt manufacturer. They don't get much yogurt from the United States. Almost all of it comes from one plant in Wisconsin. And the feeling was that was attacking Paul Ryan directly. You know, obviously that's a pretty big deal for that one yogurt plant. But once again, here's another case where a Trump policy has led to an economic down for a Wisconsin business.
Yeah, and we're actually working on another story about the impact on ginseng farmers. There's a lot of that, those kinds of farmers here in Wisconsin. So the Chinese tariffs on ginseng could be a big problem for them. So there's a lot of ginseng farmers that are very worried about that. So we're working on that story too.
I'd never thought about that. My God, you're right. Imagine what, I don't know off the top of your head, do you know what is the percentage of their exports out of this country that go to China?
I knew you were going to ask that, and I don't have that in front of me, but I'm actually not the reporter who's working on that, but I know that we're finding all that out. So if you read the Journal Sentinel next week, you'll find out.
Okay. Yeah, things are going great over there. Wow. Molly Beck, once again, you have plenty of reasons to follow Molly Beck at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as she covers politics over in Wisconsin. Kind enough today to give us the latest update on Foxconn. I know you and I are going to be talking more about this stuff before too long. Molly, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
You too. Thanks for having me.
You got it. Molly Beck, let's spotlight her interview as well. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Get your vehicle's summertime service done at Rudy Luther Toyota. The last thing you need is a breakdown while on a road trip or heading to the lake. Regardless of where you've purchased your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is your number one destination for auto service and repair. Routine maintenance or a larger repair, easily schedule your appointment on their website, RudyLutherToyota.com. I trust them. They're fast, courteous, and they do the job right. Get your vehicle summer ready at Rudy Luther Toyota, 5 miles west of downtown Minneapolis on 394.
Hello, friends. I've been talking to you about Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens, Minnesota's first green cemetery dedicated to celebrating life and protecting our environment. One of the many wonderful things they have is something called the Living Urn. Ashes are buried in an urn with seedlings, ultimately coming back to life as a glorious tree. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Why don't you log on to the website, mngreengraves.com. Learn more about Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens. See if it might be something that's meaningful for you.
Unbeatable prices? Warner Stallion guarantees it on hundreds of top-rated appliances, including laundry pairs starting at $3.99 each, free installation on select Bosch and KitchenAid dishwashers, hundreds saved on French door refrigerators. We have discounts on air conditioners, and we install. You'll save even more in-store on top brands. We guarantee unbeatable prices. Warner Stallion offers qualified buyers 18 months zero-interest financing for a limited time and only from Minnesota's original appliance specialists, Warner Stallion.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces is having its annual store-wide sale. For the entire month of July, all of our indoor and outdoor fireplace products and accessories are at their lowest price of the year. At Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, we display, explain, and install the Twin Cities' most diverse selection of indoor and outdoor stoves and fireplaces, including metal and masonry pizza ovens.
While shopping for a fireplace insert at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, I was amazed at all the choices. Not just gas, electric, or wood-burning, but also built-in or freestanding, and options in every style from antique to modern. The staff listened to us, explained the options, and helped us choose a fireplace we love. Now it warms our hearts and our home every winter. Thank you, Woodland Stoves, for a great addition.
Come see us. We have over 35 working displays in our store, which is just off I-94 at the corner of Riverside and East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, since 1977, out of the ordinary products and services to make fire work for you.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Two of my favorite people to talk to, Susan Du. Dear God, you've got to read that City Pages article. The cover story on City Pages this week. You've got to read that. You have to. It is mind-numbing. It really is. And Molly Beck from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, just top-notch. There is nothing over there in Wisconsin that's going to end up working well. I mean, it's like every – I just – how the Wisconsin Republicans think they're going to be able to run on good for business, I don't know. I mean, that's a gutsy call at this point, and that's before this trade war gets in bad. And I forgot completely about – Wisconsin's got one of the largest growers of ginseng in the nation, which you know as well as I do, most of that's going to China. It's like soybeans. That one's going to hurt. Julie is in Minneapolis. Let's get her on in here before we end the show. Welcome in, Julie.
Hi. Say, I just want to make a quick comment. I saw in the St. Paul paper today three justices, one of whom Trump said he's going to choose. He'll probably pick somebody else, but they were Amy Coney Barrett, B-A-R-R-E-T-T, Brett Kavanaugh, Raymond Ketledge, K-E-T-H-L-E-D-G-E. And I know your listeners know this, but I have to jump in about this. It's so meaningless to have a woman on the court. It's a cynical choice. I have to say something because I was a young woman when the Equal Rights Amendment was slaughtered by Republican Phyllis Schlafly, who almost single-handedly saw to it that the ERA didn't pass. Anita Bryant was a singer, and she was involved, but it was mainly Phyllis Schlafly. They didn't want to pass it because we don't want women to be able to have an abortion. But anyway, the power of one radical right gal makes a huge difference. Thank you.
Now, Julie, thank you very much. As far as you're talking about the Supreme Court, female Supreme Court nominee that's possibly run for Trump, here's what I'm going to say is, well, we should have won in 2016. I hate to be nitpicky. Okay. I want to, last night, I mean, after Trump's little speech in Montana, you know, where he goes after Elizabeth Warren, he's like, and the Republicans, well, he was trying to apologize. No, he wasn't. He was setting it up for a joke because he was playing to the crowd. He was the bad villain in a wrestling match trying to shake hands with the good guy, saying, no, this is legit. That's all it was. And you watch them, you know, as he talks about holding her down and getting, you know, or kind of paraphrasing it, but, you know, forcing her to get a DNA test to prove this, but Me Too movement's going to get all upset. You know, it just was just jackassian at its ultimate. The reality is, as those people clapped and laughed and applauded, I want to make sure everyone knows one thing. 19%. That's about it. Trump is the president for a lot of people, 19% of this country. 19% of this country who like to sit there and like racist jokes, who want to physically assault people they disagree with, who are just jerks and they like being jerks. That is who loves Trump. And Trump plays the ground. It's the same thing with Steve King. I was talking about this last night with a friend from Iowa. Steve King, that is their candidate. That guy represents them. That is who they are. In the same sense as Michelle Bachmann. That's who Minnesota 6 was until they basically realized, okay, this is nuts, and we're going to get rid of her, and she left. It doesn't do us a lot of good when 19% of the country, and granted, the media in this country focuses so hyper on that 19%. It doesn't do the other 81% of us any good to basically have 19% of the people making all the decisions. But in the system that we have, at least until this election cycle, that's the system that we have now. We don't have any option in it. So do me a favor. Don't go on out there and draw on a cardboard box with a Sharpie and hold it up and act like you're doing something. Do not go up online and make a witty social commentary on a social networking site. Get off your butts. Go this weekend. Help Democrats, especially outstate Democrats. Help them campaign. Door knock. Make a donation. Get your friends registered to vote and realize this is not a one-time deal. This is the rest of our lives. The crew is in next. I'm back on Monday. Till then, see ya.